Okay, so yeah, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. So yeah, let me start here. So the work I'm presenting today has been accomplished by a lot of people and from various institutions, and boldface are leader names. And yeah, let me single out here maybe Tonio Coelho Perez, who's now in Darmstadt. Yeah, Sushant Moore, who's now at MSU. And yeah. So I also went to the web pages, and you have challenge questions and key questions. Yeah. So what I just labeled some key questions here. One of them is from the program's web page. I think, what is the best path forward? So that's of course very ambitious. The best path, highly optimized, good to do these calculations, these insights from QCD. And then on the wiki, I think there were a lot of questions that I bold-faced here a few words that have the same common thread, namely, what about finite volume calculations in ab initio calculations, and what about Lüscher models, Lüscher methods, and extrapolation methods? And so my short answer is, well, a finite harmonic oscillator basis corresponds actually to finite volume. So in that sense, everyone who uses this has worked in a finite volume ever since. And we have actually Lüscher-like formulas for extrapolations of various bound state expectation values and matrix elements for many body systems. And I want to tell you about this in maybe the first half of this talk. So yeah, and I'm also very much like this picture here that we have seen so many times about the energy scales that we are looking at. And simply what is interesting here is that we have a separation of scale as we go from quarks and gluons to very collective states at 40 keV or so in actinides. And basically, with every separation of scale, in principle, if one thinks about EFTs, that gives us the opportunity to use effective field theories. And of course, we have heard lots about chiral EFT, how to go from quarks and gluons to pions and nucleons. And then, of course, there are other EFTs at lower energy, like pionless EFT. And today, also in the second half, I want to talk about a little bit about the effective field theory for nuclear vibrations, so where you don't resolve the fermionic nature of the atomic nucleus, and then maybe even to lower collective degrees of freedom, like rotations, where you don't even resolve vibrations. Yeah? So there's a lot of opportunities here. And of course, this is still very difficult to solve, and it becomes simpler and simpler as we go down the ladder. Yeah? I also want to remind people who are not performing ab initio coupled cluster, ab initio nuclear structure calculations based in, for instance, oscillator spaces. How is this often done? Yeah. So we often start here from interactions now from chiral EFT. They are formulated in momentum space. It's clear that's not the perfect approach, but probably the best to date. And then we transform from the momentum space to, say, finite oscillator basis. We do this because it allows us to keep rotational invariance, and it factors out the center of mass. Yeah? But also, I think we do this because the spherical mean field really reflects nuclear shell structure. So we have immediately a good and very natural starting point. Yeah? As a contrapoint, for instance, here, nuclear lattice EFD that works on a qubit lattice, of course, has a big advantage to get alpha particle cluster structure, because that is more put into the basis already. Well, once we have this interaction, then we need to transform really from the center of mass system to the laboratory frame. So this is really because we want to deal with fermions. And if you go above a handful or so, working Jacobi coordinates, the antisymmetrization is difficult. So again, the center of mass then becomes a question. It factorizes exactly in the Noether-Schell model, but it factors out to a very good approximation also in other methods. And finally, then we solve the many-body problem. And well, then maybe we go back to step number two here. We go to a different basis space. We enlarge the basis space and see how well converged are results. Yeah? So it's a loop with several technical steps here involved. And the question is, of course, immediately, how good is the approximation in step two going from momentum space to the oscillator basis? Yeah? How can one extrapolate to infinite oscillator spaces? What are infrared and ultraviolet properties of the basis? Yeah? And one can, of course, also ask, wow, why does one do this step at all? Can one not directly construct an interaction or an effective field theory in the Ostrata basis? And of course, 2 weeks ago, this was already discussed in Vic's talk. Yeah. Just one picture here to get us started. So here basically is a singlet S-channel partial wave from a chiral interaction. And it's plotted here in momentum space, V of KK prime. And I have here two plots. They look just look different. It's the same interaction just because they had slightly different scales. Yeah, but this is an interaction. And you see here somehow it's attractive at low momenta and zero or repulsive maybe here. Good. And now if you put this into an oscillator basis, well, you don't and then transform back into momentum space. Actually, this is what you get. Yeah, and you see here this is what you get in, say, 10 oscillator shells. And if you then go to 20 oscillator shells, it looks much better. Yeah? Okay. So in that sense, one could ask, well, can one not maybe even get rid of these kind of differences that we have here? And can we directly construct this in the oscillator basis? Yeah, so motivation is clear. Well, let us optimize and optimize meaning, for instance, determining low energy coefficients, yeah, and generate interactions in the basis where we actually compute in. Yeah, so in that sense, I think I always really thought this is so nice in nuclear lattice EFT, where the interaction is tailored to the model space and to the basis that one works in. And the question is, can one do the same for the oscillator? And of course, people have worried about this and wondered about this for a long time now. Yeah, the relevant works and who got us all started. Yeah, and if one looks at it from an EFT perspective, questions arise, of course, what are the infrared and UV cutoffs that such a basis exhibits? Yeah, and now we have a good answer to that. Yes?
So what exactly do you mean by optimize?
Oh, for instance, using even low energy data for many body systems to optimize, for instance, chiral interactions, so determines certain low energy coefficients, yeah, but without this long loop that I showed on the previous slide.
Okay, but how does it match the EFT? So this is not an optimization, which is, so to speak, beyond the other principles of effective field theory. You want to optimize the descriptions, specific systems, by sacrificing something, or is it just?
No, I mean, I would not, I hope not to sacrifice principles of EFD. I would just say low energy observables are fine. So as long as it's low energy or low momentum, I would say I don't care whether it comes from a two-body system or three-body system or from a 16-body system.
But in this sense, there is no optimization. This is just a determination of energy constants, I would say.
Oh, that's right. Okay,
whenever,
yes.
Whenever I hear optimize.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, I'm very happy to change this word for determination or, yeah.
So the interaction, what is the connection between that interaction regardless of the choice of law?
Yeah, well, I mean, my point is that the energy constants are just constants, so it doesn't matter how you determine them from any body system or from any body systems. This is just constants. There is not much room for optimization. Of course, usually, if you can create your expansion, you can tune them a little bit to get a little better description.
Okay, maybe then it's also a bit of fine-tuning involved, because I have a very pragmatic view that I actually we want to compute heavy nuclei or medium mass nuclei. So yes, so I'm happy to exchange this word for others.
But there is true optimization because you have low energy parameters described in your Hilbert space. And so what you want to do is you want to pick the optimal values for the lambda. So the convergence of your expansion is maximized. Your answers will always be independent of those choices if you carry them out in the necessary order, but you can optimize the convergence if you pick the very best values.
Yeah, I think I come to this also in a few minutes. Yeah. And if one wants to do this in the Ostrata basis, of course, we want to use also scattering data and nucleon-nucleon scattering data to determine the interaction. And of course, the computation of scattering phase shifts directly in the Ostrata basis has been done before, and we build on works that go back decades, because that is very useful to us. Yeah. So if one thinks about EFT and the OSS databases, maybe the one of the first questions one can ask is simply, what are the eigenvalues of the kinetic energy in the harmonic oscillator basis? And so here, I have a space consisting of 20 shells, and I look at S states, and well, if you diagonalize P squared, this is, for instance, two of the lowest wave functions that you simply get. Yeah, and what you see immediately is, or what is interesting maybe, wow, that looks almost like a wave function in a spherical cavity or in a box. Yeah, there's somehow if you hard ball somewhere here, and indeed, well, we have a very good approximation of where this hard wall looks like. I come to this in a minute. Yeah, but clearly we have just momentum eigenstates, but on a with discrete momenta. Yeah, and actually one can not only solve this problem numerically, but rather analytically. Yeah, and if you are in a partial wave of angular momentum L, and have something like up to 2n plus L states in there, yeah, then you have the eigenvalues k mu, so mu goes now from 0 to n, so n plus 1 values, are actually roots of the associated Laguerre polynomials Ln plus 1. So this is just a Laguerre polynomial that's outside your basis. Yeah? So that sense, and when you look at this and think about this a little bit longer, then you immediately see, oh, the eigenfunctions of p squared actually are a so-called discrete valuable representation, the DVR. So I have plots here, again, in momentum space now. So previously I showed you the eigenfunction position space. Now it's in momentum space, here for a Hilbert space of just 10 oscillator shells. And what you see here is really in different colors, the different eigenfunctions, and vertical lines denote the eigenvalues. And what you see here, you have, it's very interesting, so DVR basically means you have wave functions that are orthogonal to each other. They are peaked at or close to these discrete eigenvalues, and they are exactly zero at all other eigenvalues. So they are basically, they're not completely normalized here, they are normalization coefficients, but otherwise they basically fulfill Kronecker delta relationships. So this, they are basically discrete lattice points. Yeah. So, and this is how these wave functions look like. And this now is very useful if you want to actually compute matrix elements. For instance, you have matrix element from chiral EFT or from any other interaction in momentum space at a different partial wave. You just have to multiply this with these normalization coefficients because the wave function will not unit height, yeah? And then you can immediately get the interaction matrix element in the eigenstates of the kinetic energy. So it's a very simple recipe, no transformation involved really, and it makes it simple. So, and if you ask, you can also ask yourself, okay, what does it really mean? Is this an approximation? It is, yeah, it is a DVR approximation of a finite basis, and you could get that same if you were perform all numerical integrations or quadratures with n plus 1 point Gauss-Laguerre quadrature. Yeah, then you get the same result. Yeah. Good, and if you are in such a DVR, scalar products become very simple. You don't need to integrate, you just evaluate functions at the discrete momentum points, have these normalization coefficients in there. So this makes it very simple. And an insight then is also, of course, you can now, you have analytically determined the momenta or the kinetic energy in the oscillator basis. So it's clear that the lowest momentum is pi over the relevant infrared length scale. And then actually you find that L is, you can also do this analytically. You can search for the lowest eigenvalue. So this is actually how we did it. But if we would have known that these are just the zeros of Laguerre polynomials, we could have looked up already a very old book and immediately say estimates about the zeros of these Laguerre polynomials. And this is a very good estimate. Schlegel already knew this.
So it's your first line, is it saying just that the Fourier transform of a harmonic oscillator is a harmonic oscillator?
It uses this, but no, because these states here are not oscillator states. These states are the discrete momentum eigenstates. So they look like sinusoidal waves. Yeah. So you when you derive it, it is useful to know that.
You're doing the transformation from the plane wave into the oscillator basis.
Yeah. That's right. I use that information. Yeah. And by the way, so also if once you have a partial wave decomposition of, for instance, three body forces, it's the same game. Yeah? You can easily translate this into the oscillator simply by using this correspondence. Okay, so we have now determined this basically the size of the finite oscillator, as we call it let me maybe go back. We call it L2 simply because your naive estimate, of course, would have been just n plus 3/2 square root of this times the oscillator length. Yeah, but in fact, you have a small correction there if you want to get it more precise. Yeah, that's why we call it L2, this is 2 involved there. This means now we have a finite basis size, so it looks almost as if there would be a hard wall at this distance. And this means the wave functions that you compute really for bound states are not only exponentially decaying, of course there is an exponentially increasing part to make a node at r equal to L2. Yeah? And once you know this, of course, then you can compute what are corrections to energies and other observables that you compute, because, for instance, this wave function has too much curvature, so we have too much energy, and it gives the radii, in that sense, wrongly, but you can now correct for this. And for instance, if you do this, you find the Lüscher-like formulas, the radius that you compute at a given length, L, yeah, is really the infinite radius plus this correction here. Yeah. And you can also look at how the infinite radius squared is related to the radius that you compute. Yeah. And here we have examples for the deuteron. And you see, as you plot things as a function of L2, data points here are numerical results. You see how beautiful they line up on a very smooth line, both for the energies and for the radii. And then you can make fits with these formulas. So it's basically, when you go back to Lüscher formulas, of course, with periodic boundary conditions, you can lower your energy. Your computed result is too low because you can tunnel from one box to the next box. Here, of course, your computed result is too high because you have a Dirichlet boundary condition. Yeah, and so here's an example, for instance, for the radius. This is a range where we used the data to fit and to make a prediction. And if you here, I have here leading order and next to leading order correction. Here we actually plotted the next term is just a constant, also C2. And you see here, you get very good examples compared to the exact result. You get very close to the exact result. So this seems to be working rather well. So now, because you are in the monomic oscillator, you can start thinking about more than the two-body problem, because the idea always remains the same. Compute the eigenvalues of the kinetic energy and compare with the corresponding hyperspherical cavity to find the effective radius. Yeah? So I just showed you how to do this in a single particle case. If you go to a product space, for instance, spaces that are used by a couple cluster in medium SRG and many other methods, yeah. You have a product space and you have a fermion in a 3D cavity. You can compute the kinetic energy and compare this with time-ordered Bessel function results. And okay, here's a formula that relates the momentum eigenvalues to Bessel function zeros. And you can get the effective length there. Likewise, if you go to the Noether-Schell model, this is now a Hilbert space where you allow for all excitations up to a certain energy n. So that's a very complicated space if you think about it in a many-body sense. But if you now think that it's just a single particle in 3 times A dimensions, it becomes very simple because it's just a single particle in a hyperspherical well. Yeah? And then using that information, you can here, this is just a formula that uses basically Bessel functions or generalizations of Bessel functions in higher dimensions to get the zeros at the lowest eigenvalues, and from there you can get a length scale. Yeah? So this works quite well, and in that sense we have Lüscher formulas now available for the many body spaces we are actually working in. Yeah. I want to show here one example for the infrared lengths in the Noether-Schell model space. So these are busy results. So this is a calculation of lithium-6 ground state with two-body interactions, yeah, and color-coded is here now. We take an oscillator space. It has a certain length, yeah, and so we can call it L2, and it has a certain ultraviolet cutoff that is basically, if you understand the extent in position space, you understand the extent of momentum space. You can also basically, for every data point, record what is actually the UV momentum of that model space. Yeah, and you see here colors go from pink to dark red over green to from low to high momentum. And if you plot things as a function of L2, you would think, okay, you get an envelope here, but you do not really get it, as you get the higher momentum points, for instance, lie off this envelope. Now, it might be a small shift, but you might want to care about this if you want to do extrapolations to be really very precise. If you take now this effective L that comes from a hyperspherical well that we just presented on the last curve, now you see the highest momentum points are certainly the best converge, and they are really on the lower side of this envelope. Yeah? And you can make very nice extrapolations. And here you see, okay, on a log scale, so it's only about one decade, you see here how well things are looking linear, so you have this exponential decay. So now, having this knowledge, you can it becomes really just an industry to extend this to other observables of interest, in particular long-range observables of interest. Yeah, so this we have the challenges, for instance, also to get magnetic moments right, but that's more short-range and cannot be addressed in this way. But for instance, quadrupole momenta, yeah, again, like the radius, the leading term is the same. Yeah. Or E2 transition amplitudes between two states. Yeah, you can get an exponential formula. Even for radiative capture corrections, we very recently derived a formula. And actually, we saw this is relevant if you do, for instance, ab initio calculations of radiative capture on the Dutron or so. You want to get, if you aim at really precision of a 1% level or so, you need actually to have these corrections in even in Hilbert spaces that are as large as 30 fermion extent. Yeah, so it's here, if you, I didn't write down this formula, but here in this formula, because you go from the continuum to a bound state, this factor 2 is missing, and so you have a much slower decay, in particular to something shallow bound, and so it's actually of relevance, yeah. And I have here plots simply for these observables. So as a function of this L effective, you see now here these are certain data points, and now you can extrapolate for both here the quadrupole moment and the transition amplitudes. And it seems to be working rather well.
What is K level?
Well, in the yeah, you have transition. You have two, at least you have two momenta involved. And well, here now, this is the momentum of the lowest state that you go to, not the higher state. So this was derived for transitions between two bound states. We have not yet derived this between a transition between a continuum state and a bound state. Then most likely from this work, I would, yeah, this factor goes away, but it will be, yeah. But here, this is the lower momentum you go to. Yes.
So Thomas, this K infinity, is that corresponding pretty well with the low separation momentum?
Good question. In the two body system, we have a very good understanding about the K infinity as actually the bound state momentum. Yeah. But in many body systems, it's not entirely clear. Yeah. So naively, I would have thought that this should be the separation momentum. But then one is also in a situation, so all these formulas here, let me just go back maybe to these formulas here. All these formulas are just leading order formulas. So they go really, they hold in the asymptotic regime where K infinity L is a very large quantity. And there are other corrections, power laws and higher exponentials here. And it's in the many body system, we do not understand well at all what are these higher order corrections. So we see just from experience here when we fit, yeah? But with the data that we have available, for instance, here, is only about one decade. So it's very difficult to extract really the higher order corrections. So in those calculations, actually, when we fit, we take K infinity as a fit parameter, not as a known observable. I think this is for two reasons. One, really, sometimes it's very hard to go out to this absolutely asymptotic region where 1 over KL is already a small number. Yeah, so there are still open questions.
So it's usually when you do these fits, it's usually a bit bigger than the separation momentum.
I'm not sure. For some systems, okay, here for lithium, yes, for instance, yeah. So lithium, of course, would just maybe 2 MeV or so, like the deuteron, but it's larger, yes, it's larger, and it could very well be that it mocks up higher order correction that we don't have because we don't have really good data here and precision in this case. But we can, of course, compare these results, for instance, for instance, here Noether-Schell model calculations in larger and larger spaces. And there we actually see, well, these extrapolations work quite well. Yeah.
So how do you formally define Hill effective? You've got a Hilbert space that's completely defined by lambda, the number of oscillator quanta, and V.
Yes.
So there ought to be a formula that says that L equals.
Yeah. Yes. So here is the formula. Yeah. Let me go back maybe the simplest case for the one body or relative coordinate two body problem. Yeah, there we have basically the lowest momentum is pi, that's the zero of a Bessel function, over the relative length scale. So, or if I square this, I have the kinetic energy. So we now just go into the many-body system, like in the Noether-Schell model. It's a hypospherical system of one particle in 3a-1 dimensions. We compute the lowest state of the kinetic energy and compare this to the lowest state of a hypospherical well. And thereby, by basically equating, so this is a symbolic form of equating here the kinetic energy and here X here stands for pi or something like this.
We
compute the energy, we match it to what would be the result in a hypospherical well, and that gives us the effective length.
So we think that how we do it, we just have the exact formula for the correction to the kinetic energy as a functional lambda V for all states.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we would never think about introducing artificial radius because it's not really in a box.
Oh, no, I disagree with you there, because if you just compute the eigenvalues of p squared, they look like a particle in a box, and even if you go to larger and larger spaces, you, for instance, would see that the lowest k's are really equidistant, so it's exactly as you would think about a spherical cavity.
You know, if you think about the kinetic energy operator, it's just like the potential. It has to be inserted in all possible ways. So it's associated, I mean, if you think about a scattering diagram, you've got to do the iteration of that, the parts of the kinetic energy you leave out over all times. And so we have an effective operator that we know exactly captures that physics with a harmonic oscillator. So we can exactly give you the expectation value in infinite space of the kinetic energy for any finite Hilbert space from any state.
Yes.
And we would never introduce an artificial radius that doesn't have any connection to the harmonic oscillator.
I don't think that this is an artificial radius. This is just when you work in this, if you work in the space, this is the lowest momentum you get. It's nothing, it's completely determined by the number of oscillator shells and the oscillator length. So this is just an inherent quality or property of the harmonic oscillator basis.
I guess I'm asking, why are you putting it in a box?
I don't put it in a box. I wanted to say here that a finite oscillator of n shells at low energies is indistinguishable. So it's an EFT sense, indistinguishable from a spherical cavity.
So this is a matching calculation between the oscillator and the EFT for it.
Yeah.
But in the real world, what's left out of the box is all the harmonic oscillator states that you haven't included. And you know how to do the kinetic summation over those exactly. Sorry, what is the box? What is doing this buying you?
Oh, no. What is buying me is if I stay in a finite oscillator box, obviously we can only cut, well, so far, so we have energy independent Hamiltonians. All the infrastructure that we have is for finite Hilbert spaces, and we like to use finite oscillator spaces for the reason I mentioned. And then simply it is important for us to know what are the corrections to our computed observables at low energy due to the limitations of a finite oscillator basis. So in that sense, I would view them exactly equivalent to Lüscher formulas that give you what are the corrections on a finite lattice.
All I'm saying is that that's exactly the same question we've asked. And we know the exact answer for the harmonic oscillator. Mm-hmm. We don't ever introduce the box. We know the Green's function.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
And we know it's simple to take from the free Green's function to calculate exactly mm-hmm. the emitted physics. So we can tell you precisely in a finite box what the effective kinetic energy is for any state in that box.
Yes.
Arbitrary accuracy.
Yes.
And we would never introduce a radius or anything else to a match or anything of that sort, because we know how to do that problem without just directly.
That's fine. In my view, if I would like to stay with energy independent Hamiltonians, and this is so far the way how I understand it best.
Could you kind of explain this also?
Yes, so basically, because the Green's function is exactly known in the oscillator basis. So here, people already used that property decades ago to compute phase shifts. Yeah. So yes, you can. Yeah. Yes. I do not know this, but okay. Oh no. Good. So yes. So of course, an underlying assumption, of course, of all these formulas here is. So this is clearly the asymptotic tail beyond where basically your mean field potential or your range ends. So it's clear if you are in an oscillator space where this size, the effective size of your space, is smaller than the radius of the nucleus or the range of the interaction, then of course none of this is valid.
So there are corrections which involve the ratio of the effective range to the effective length of your process, right?
In leading, there are now higher order corrections to this. And for instance, for the deuteron, we could work this out to a higher precision. And there, again, once you are in this regime, you do not need to know about these corrections.
So all the coefficients are going to be effective range expansion for the deuteron, about the deuteron pole. You're just expanding around you've moved if you look at the S matrix in this, you're not at the pole anymore, but you know how to go nearby because you have an effective range expansion. So it's all determined in the two body, and we don't know how to do it.
Yeah, we have no idea how to do it in the many bodies. So maybe last thing is, then also you can ask, of course, what is the ultraviolet cutoff of a finite oscillator space? And well, of course, in an oscillator basis, momentum and position is dual. So now here you would basically compute the smallest eigenvalue of the ray in a spherical oscillator of r squared, and from there get the highest momentum. Yeah, and this is here a plot of a deuteron, where now it is shown that basically this is actually resembles really a hard cutoff. Yeah, so here is a deuteron computation. And as a function of the cutoff of the oscillator basis, and we take a Hamiltonian and soften it here with regulators, n can be a larger number here, n is 2, 4, 8. Yeah? And you see now here from various data how things converge as you increase your oscillator UV cutoff, as you increase your oscillator basis. Yeah? And you see here, envelope is forming, and actually it corresponds to n to infinity, yeah, and these data points are actually results in a finite oscillator space. So in that sense, we also have a good understanding about the oscillator. And again, like in position space, it finite oscillator space at low energy resembles a spherical cavity with a hard wall. It's the same in momentum space. It resembles a hard momentum wall. So now this motivates us basically to avoid one problem, namely one hard problem in our case has always been that we have to have larger and larger model spaces. We know now, for instance, it's clear that the ultraviolet cutoff of the oscillator space has to be larger than the ultraviolet cutoff of the interaction. But usually, because that is a momentum space and some super Gaussian decay, it does not really match too well with the oscillator, and you have to go far beyond that. Yeah? So here, just for instance, an example, maybe I should have said that here. You see, this interaction somehow has a cutoff of just 500 MeV. Yet you see here many of the data points go beyond 1,000 MeV. Yeah? So there's a lot of work involved to really be precise. And so the motivation is now, well, maybe we can change this now. Determine, not optimized, yeah, we determine and construct the interaction directly in the oscillator basis. This means we take a finite oscillator space for the interaction, for the potential, and then we only increase the kinetic energy as we go along and check the convergence, and we can then apply these Lüscher-like formulas that we have. Yeah? So in that sense, UV convergence is set in by construction as we have the cutoff chosen very commensurate, ideal with the underlying lattice, the underlying Hilbert space. Really, I think my analogy is again the lattice, yeah, where the cutoff is so natural to the whole framework of calculation. So what we did now here is we actually constructed a next to leading order interaction in chiral EFT, yeah, in an oscillator space of 10 shells and with a certain frequency. And for instance, here are examples just of phase shifts. Yeah? So here you see still remnants of the oscillator basis because there are small oscillations. Yeah? And so in that sense, but you can use this now and to fit to phase shift. If we compute these points here, actually denote points, the discrete eigenvalues that are computed in this procedure because we have a finite oscillator space. And those completely lie on the phase shift line, but then we have small oscillations around this. Yeah, and we could use this, basically these old papers about how to do J matrix physics in the oscillator basis to construct an interaction.
What is the line?
So the line is here, the phase shift to what we optimize to. Yeah. So we, for instance, we worked here at next to leading order, and we use just a phase shift. This is not from a partial wave decomposition, but from another interaction. Yeah, that we just looked at. And so this is more proof of principle study. So we had phase shifts. We wanted to determine certain low energy coefficients at next to leading order to match those phase shifts. Yeah? And in a final oscillator basis, basically the blue line is what you get. And at 10 shells, if you go here somehow to 40 shells or so, then you get these green points, and you see that there's a convergence there. And then the interesting thing was for us, we took then this interaction. Yeah. So it was defined in a model space of just 10 shells, but then we went to larger model spaces where only the kinetic energy extends beyond these 10 shells. And then we computed from helium-4 to TIN-132, and you see here how very quickly results actually converge. Yeah. So that's really, for practitioners, I would say that's a very encouraging convergence. Yeah. And then we can do a fit and from these Lüscher-like formulas and get results here. And of course, I compare it here to the experiment to say you, no surprise, at next to leading order, you cannot expect much from a nuclear interaction. There are no three body forces, for instance. But this was just a case study that in principle we can construct an interaction by adjusting it to phase shifts. And then we can actually compute heavy nuclei and get a rather quick convergence. So model spaces of 14 or 16 oscillator shells are no problem for us. Yeah?
This oscillation looks really odd. I mean, when we do our fit with the harmonic oscillator, it's absolutely perfect and smooth.
Absolutely.
You can completely predict the behavior.
That's right.
It looks like you're pinning this thing. but that the physics in between the points where you pin is not right because it's not having the right shape.
Yes, to a certain extent, and I have one more slide on this point. Yeah. So I agree with you because we have only a finite number of states. It's clear things must be oscillatory. They cannot be completely smooth or not completely straight as one had it in an infinite space that, for instance, you are working with.
So I think the issue is, what bothers me about putting it, having this box structure for the Luger formula.
Yes.
The kinetic energy in a plane wave basis is fundamentally different from the kinetic energy in a harmonic oscillator. In the harmonic oscillator, it's a hopping operator. So
yes.
That means that in a plane wave basis, it's diagonal. And so that means that the effective operator in the two spaces are different. If you just say use the kinetic energy in the box and the kinetic energy in the harmonic oscillator, you won't get equivalent answers. But the correction in a harmonic oscillator is really simple. It's actually this T plus T Q over E times T. That's the effective operator. But that's always going to be different for you because of the fact that the operators act once a diagonal and momentum base, once non-diagonal.
Yes, so...
In the old J-matrix language, it means you can't fix the kinetic energy by adding a perfect tail because it's not just in the infrared, it's everywhere. All possible insertions of the kinetic energy have to be added.
I would think my answer to this would be that we don't need to be exact. What we need to be is basically correct at low momentum. Yeah? We do effective field theory. So in that sense, I would argue, and I have one more slide on this, that this is from a few months ago, actually published, but we have now a better understanding of how to avoid this and basically how to get the low momentum physics here without these kind of oscillations. Yes? And there are still things at higher momentum or higher energy, but we don't care much about because this is an EFT. And in that sense, it's still systematically improvable. So maybe...
Mars is an EFT too, and it has a much prettier, smoother behavior.
Rick, that is all fine. I just see the machinery that we have is for energy-independent Hamiltonians. And we can go... The infrastructure is there to compute a 100-body system. So, of course, I'm really very much motivated in this approach. We were motivated by the fact that the lattice is also, any discrete or finite base is not perfect, but it's certainly good enough to low energy physics to do effective field theory. And we only wanted to see this is one way, I think, to do it in the oscillator. Yeah? So here is again this plot that I have shown you early on. So this is, for instance, in the singlet S channel for a certain interaction with a certain cutoff. And what is also shown here is basically here somehow the infrared cutoff and the UV cutoff of, this has no bearing here in this plot, but here, when we go to the oscillator space, actually has a bearing. Yeah. So here's the infrared cutoff, here's the UV cutoff. And you see, if you go, as I showed you in this DVR sense, in the harmonic oscillator, you get something different. And of course, you have oscillations here, and clearly these oscillations are then also reflected in the phase shifts. Yeah? But now what you can do is you can actually improve this, because you see, I have not done here is superimpose also the lines of the discrete momentum eigenvalues we have in our oscillator space. Yeah? And of course, if I now go all the way back to the beginning, excuse me here for this movie, remember, for instance, even the highest momentum here, well, this is basically momentum eigenfunctions really times k. It starts all linearly and not constant. Yeah, you see also the highest wave is always oscillating a little bit. This means now what we do is we can readjust this height of this potential at this very high momentum. So think about this here being a superposition of all these curves that are peaked around the discrete momenta, but then have still some oscillations. And now here we just readjusted the strength at the highest momentum, because we're an EFT, we don't care about high momentum physics, to get the low momentum physics more accurate. And now you see here, even in 10 shells, so this means just 6 S shells, this is such a nice and smoother picture than this here. and it completely removes the oscillations at low energies that I have shown you in the last slide. Yeah, so again, you see now here.
Can you repeat really what you do? I mean, you try to avoid the oscillations at low momentum by adjusting their high momentum states?
That's right. By basically,
by hand. I mean, or do you have any?
No, you see.
Any.
I do it. So, this was so far the way. In a DVR, this is how you translate matrix element directly to your discrete value representation. Yeah. And as you see, if one does this, okay, this is the outcome. But now we are not interested in exploiting, well, the DVR makes calculation of matrix element convenient, but we want to construct an EFT in the spaces. So in that sense, it's clear I could take the highest momentum over a matrix element and just change this by hand to adjust it so that I get the low energy coefficients. The low energy behavior right. The simplest examples I can give you is, for instance, for contact interaction. Yeah? A contact interaction would be so I would say, right, V of K prime K is just G of K prime times G of K, maybe times a constant if it's negative or so. Yeah? And so now a pure contact would be just a constant value. If you now actually do a DVR, what you see is this is what you get. Yeah. So it falls off because it's very high. So this is k at very high momentum. You have just no oscillator basis, and you certainly and you can think this curve is now a sum, right? Somehow we have your discrete. You have discrete values, and actually the DVR is always such that at these discrete values, you get exactly the potential that you want. But in between, you make mistakes. Mm-hmm. So now you can readjust the strength of that point here. And actually make it much, much smaller. Yeah. So in that sense, you take the high momentum point, it's an EFT, you don't care about the high momentum, and correct the infrared behavior.
Is there a way that you introduce some kind of smooth cutoff?
I would say basically the idea is basically
the smooth regulator, sorry.
The regulator right, gets a little bit smaller, but the point is here.
That you only affect the high energy behavior.
That's right. The DVR is
but you,
fixed at certain discrete points. We would love to fix it at zero. So basically, we change one of the DVR points, it becomes incorrect here, to a new DVR point here.
So it's a kind of smoothness.
It was already smooth before,
additionally smooth.
Yes, that's
right. You have to smooth, I think, I mentioned it once before, I mean, from periodic orbit theory, you know that there are funny orbits that go from the interaction zone to the container wall, mm-hmm. the finite system, mm-hmm. and they are rare for finite containers, mm-hmm. and they are not physical. Mm-hmm. They are of course linked to a procedure that you would like to match a discrete system on a continuous system.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this is of course wrong because you can match of course certain discrete points to points in a continuous system, but not smoothly. Where the level density would be. And the way out is, of course, a smoothing procedure.
Yeah, and you see here, I mean, here at higher energies, you see at high momenta, these two pictures differ, but at low momenta, they don't. Yeah, and so in that sense, so it's called IR improved, or we call it this way, but we can put one of these points basically to zero and thereby very much, I would say, really now have an EFT. Not just a DVR, but an EFT that is actually correct at low momenta.
So why is it just one point?
If you want, a DVR in general has this property that at the discrete points it reproduces exactly potential. If you want to do more fixing here, you have to liberate more values here.
Is this pictured with just one?
Yes. Yes, it is. It really is. And it simply comes in from the fact that all these curves have zero slope here. So if you fix it here and give it the same value, it cannot do much. And you can do this also, we have done this now also in P wave and D waves. So we can get very smooth interactions that when we compare the oscillator space matrix element with the continuum space matrix element at low energies, we are very satisfied with the way how the interaction looks.
But I think the problem is with the harmonic oscillator is that there are excitations that live at very high energy that are extremely low momentum. And it's this basic theorem in an effective theory that if you want to build a short range effective theory, there's no substitute but to built in right asymptotic behavior. And the asymptotic behavior of a box is fundamentally different from that of a harmonic oscillator. It's just the effect that you're seeing. In a harmonic oscillator, clearly the levels as you go up in the box gets closer together. In a box, they stay extended.
But say I would...
That's the energy dependence of the effective interaction you don't like, but that's the physics.
No, you see, that's fine with me to work with energy-dependent interactions. But from a pragmatic point, of course, we know that we can converge results in a harmonic oscillator very well. So that statement that one cannot work in a fine oscillator is from a practical point of view, not a concern.
You can mock up infrared behavior by using short range operators. But if you do that and you calculate your wave function, which is the real test, you will not get any wave function that you can simply relate to the exact wave function.
But then, if this is not working, then I'm surprised that calculations on the lattice work, because in my view, we do that. The lattice certainly, they don't put it in a box, they put it in a box of periodic boundary conditions.
The lattice starts with a plane wave basis and ends with a plane wave basis. So they're using a basis on a lattice, and then they want to take the lattice to infinity. Mm-hmm. The kinetic energy operator in those two Hilbert spaces is exactly the same as diagonal. You have two Hilbert spaces that you're trying to match, one of which is not diagonal in the G. G is the infrared operator, and the other one is diagonal. So you have different effective operators in the two spaces.
Which, from a practical point of view, it cannot be a concern because there must be hundreds of calculations that show that this works.
Again, if you just look at Peter LaPage's summer school. He says if you're going to build an effective theory, you better build in exactly the proper infrared behavior. Well, you don't, because you cannot absorb that into short-range operators.
But on the lattice, the rotation symmetry is not there. I mean, but you recover it eventually.
Yes. Of course.
So it's the same thing.
Yes.
No, it's not. Gaussian symmetry of the local recover, but IR never recover, right? That's
correct. So the infrared is never. You have to project.
Always violating that box.
Okay. But you see here, the ground state energy certainly converges, and you might not be happy with the precision of what we get, but it is clear that the last thing you spend computational energy or effort on is building this tail of the wave function. And you see very well how this tail is being built, even in a finite system. So there cannot be a doubt that the finite system can compute these properties very well. You make a mistake, but this mistake is exponentially small.
Thomas, have you looked also at the scattering lengths of the effective range?
Coming soon, yes. So basically, not in my talk, but coming soon. With Aina Bansal and Sven Binder and Goethe, we are working on basically doing very cleanly what we hope pionless EFT in the spaces. Yeah, so basically, so that we can really fit to scattering length or to an effective range expansion, and then use this interaction to compute white nuclei.
So, is it this smoothing procedure that you have mentioned to have in principle enough flexibility to fit to scattering
lengths? That's right. So basically, since we have the contact in there, and if we take the contact of the DVR, as I told you, we have these oscillations, then we make this infrared improvement by basically shifting one DVR point from high momentum to zero. And we do this for this contact, and then we can fix the strength of it and, for instance, tune it to the scattering length. And it's really still work under progress, but I'm very encouraged that this will succeed. Good. So I don't know. I'm almost here talking for 1 hour. I can stop any time. Yeah.
Actually, you've only talked for about half an hour.
Effectively. Yeah.
But okay, but you have here all been with me for at least 1 hour now. So I would like to continue a little bit here, but I can stop any moment. Yeah. So EFTs for heavy nuclei, and this is a plot where all even known nuclei are shown, and what is plotted here is the ratio of the 4 plus excited state of the energy to the 2 plus excited state. And then you have basically, when you look at it here, at least for heavy nuclei, you have a lot of red regions. This means where this ratio is 10 over 3. This is exactly what you get from a rotational spectrum J times J plus 1. And then there are certain regions closer to closed shells here where this ratio is equal to 2, as you would expect it for a harmonic oscillator or vibrations. Yeah? So in that sense, people talk about, of course, rotors and vibrators. And we want to develop EFTs or consider EFTs for this. Yeah? So what you will see in a moment is that these are really two different physical situations. So you get two different EFTs. So these are both heavy nuclei or all heavy nuclei. In rotors, there's basically an emergent breaking of rotation symmetry. I elaborate of this in a moment, yeah? And you need to have an EFT that is a nonlinear realization of spherical symmetry via Nambu-Goldstone bosons or Nambu-Goldstone realization. And for vibrations, you simply take the rotation symmetry and the usual Wigner-Weil linear realization. So to belabor this point once more, so, and I'm sorry for those who that is very elemental and theory. So here's two spectra of two different heavy nuclei. One of them is ytterbium 172. This is one of the rare earth nuclei far away from closed shells. And one is here tellurium 120. So similar mass number, very heavy, yeah? But you see here quite a difference. So what you see here are states of positive parity, 0, 2, 4 plus, and so on. So you can build all these states from quadrupole excitations. Here also 0, 2, 4 plus, 6 plus. But you see very different spectra. For tellurium, for instance, you see almost equidistant here. And you have even here quasi-degenerate with a 4 plus, a 0 plus, and a 2 plus. And if you just take a quadrupole degree of freedom and make a harmonic oscillator out of it, a quadratic form, you would get exactly this spectrum that there is a one phonon state, and at twice the energy there are 3 2 phonon states. If you look at this nucleus, things are very different. So here, typical excitation energy is maybe 500 keV, also half an MeV. But here you have very low-lying excitations. You have really rotational band. And then you have maybe what people call perhaps a vibrational state. And on top of this, you have again a vibrational band. And these moments of inertias are quite close to each other. Yeah. So this here is, of course, nuclear rotation. So again, I use this word emergent breaking of rotational symmetry from really spherical symmetry to just axial symmetry. And you can build an EFT of this. And then here, this is just the normal EFT. So good. These nuclei are, of course, time or not described by very nice and powerful models. Yeah, we have various models here. And very recently, deformed nuclei have also been computed ab initio. So, of course, here these red dots here, yeah, that are deformed, yeah, and then also here in the SD shell here, for instance, magnesium 24 and so on. Yeah, we have seen results from effective interactions on this. Okay, so we want to use the separation of scale to make an EFT out of this. So and. Let me basically tell you just technically what this means is, if you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking, one knows how to build EFTs very well. Yeah, they have to work on the coset here, SO3 over SO2, which is just a two-sphere. And this just means, okay, you have two rotation angles and everything lifts here in this tangential plane. Yeah, this is how it works. Yeah, and you can add further degrees of freedom to this tangential plane. Interestingly, you can even add a monopole field to introduce basically finite ground state spins and describe odd mass or odd nuclei. Yeah, so that's straightforward. One word on this emergent symmetry breaking. Of course, finite systems really, so this technique that I just showed are well known for systems with spontaneous symmetry breaking. But of course, nucleus is a finite system, so it cannot really exhibit spontaneous symmetry breaking. And you see, as you saw, all the states have good angular momentum. No? This is a quantum number. So instead, Janowicz and Landmann introduced the word of emergent symmetry breaking in finite systems. So, and just to contrast this, right, an infinite system, of course, Hilbert spaces with different orientations of the nucleus are inequivalent. Yeah? There's no rotation, no unitary transformation that can really connect those two. Yeah? In finite systems, of course, Hilbert spaces with different orientations are connected by a rotation. So, this means the zero mode, this rotational mode, or if you like, a purely time-dependent Nambu-Goldstone mode exists. In field theory, you have no purely time-dependent modes. They are also always spatially and time-dependent. Yeah? Of course, you have to add this. And this mode is not a small mode because it can go all around 2 pi. Yeah? So you have to fully take this into account. Yeah? People have studied this already decades ago when basically people were worried about simulating infinite systems in finite calculations. Yeah? Gasser and Leutwiler about pions physics. Yeah, here Hasenfratz and Niedermeyer about ferromagnets. And okay, these are nice references. I would say where of course you get these rotational spectra that you have to divide out if you want to do the intrinsic physics. And otherwise, if you want to do an EFT for this spontaneous symmetry breaking, of course this has been well developed over the years, and here are references in condensed matter physics for antiferromagnets or ferromagnets.
So I'm just trying to catch up.
Yes.
So the symmetry break, are you trying to understand the transition from vibration to rotation, or are you trying to understand?
I try to basically motivated by this very different spectra. It's clear something must going on.
Right.
And so what's going on there is we talk about these nuclei are deformed, they can rotate. But of course, really strictly speaking, a finite system cannot be deformed, or more exact, it would be deformed in its intrinsic frame.
Right.
And to cast out these different physical situations, we start from two different viewpoints. To build an EFT for these intrinsically deformed system, we actually start from a non-linearization because it's very close to spontaneous symmetry breaking. The only modification of this time or not EFT there is that you have to also include this zero mode. That's all. Or did I answer?
So how do you restore the symmetry? Where do you go to get the symmetry back?
Because I have one mode that is the full rotation of the system. That mode that is, in infinite ferromagnet, I rotate my spins locally and in time. But of course, I cannot rotate all spins by the same amount. That would be a rotation of the whole system. That's not allowed. In this case, that mode in a finite system, that mode, of course, is allowed. But it's not a small amplitude mode. It can be very large. And you have to have that mode in the EFT. And good. No surprise here. You get just having this basically this particle on the sphere, you can make an EFT very quickly for this leading order, next to leading order. You get this well-known expansion, of course, that Bohr and Modelson already knew, that energies can be expanded in powers of angular momentum, spin I times I plus 1. Yeah? And likewise, you can work out what are quadrupole transitions within a band, and there's a leading order term here. So we have divided out here the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, so it's just a constant, and then there's again an I-dependent, spin-dependent term. Yeah? So there's really no surprise here. Keywords like variable moment of inertia, Mikhailov theory. So if you get any nuclear physics book, you will find those. Yeah, but I would say the EFT now also provides us with some insights into how these parameters scale or how natural are things. And we looked here, Tonio, we looked at various rotors. So we looked at molecules, N2 and H2. Yeah. And then looked at some rotational nuclei. So these are nuclei far away from shell closures. And then also so-called transitional nuclei that are a little bit closer to between vibrational and where the emergent symmetry breaking is not that pronounced. Yeah? And great, when we have an small expansion parameter, rotational scale over vibrational scale, and you see here it increases as we go down here. Yeah, molecules are of course perfect rotors. We know all this. Nuclei are much orders of magnitude worse rotors, but still they are rotors. And then these transition nuclei are again order of magnitude worse. And yes, our LECs that we need to fit the spectrum very much reflects this natural scale. So that's why we have it in there. And even if we look at transition strength, that's also reflected. Yeah. So then we can look at, for instance, a quadrupole transition strength. Again, the clutch has been divided out. So in leading order for a perfect rotor, you would just have a straight line here. And here for the nitrogen molecule, you see this is a scale here. This is just 4% deviation. So it's a very good rotor. And we have here just uncertainty estimates from naive estimates of this power counting of this ratio here. Yeah. And blue here, the next to leading order, you see is already with an estimate. It's completely within the dots. It's a really wonderful rotor. If you go then to a heavy nucleus like uranium, well, things are a little bit more over the line and good, but consistent with data. Erbium also here maybe. And then if you go to samarium, that's now more interesting. So here you see, we would love to do here the next to leading order correction like here, this blue line. But the data is so imprecise that you have no chance here. Yeah. So in that sense, we go to a nucleus that is transitional, where this ratio now is not 0.06, but rather 0.1, yeah, or here 0.2. And then basically, next to leading order correction become actually measurable. And these nuclei have also been the focus of research much later than these ones. So we have more precise data. And you see here, for instance, samarium, we have leading order, next to leading order, but you also see at a high spin, the next to leading order estimates are uncertainty estimate is of the same size as the leading order. This is where the picture breaks down. That's also, again, consistent with excited states, other excited states in samarium that has not been included in the effective theory. So what is interesting when we did this, actually, Bohr and Models already in 1975 lamented in their textbook that the precision or accuracy of many of these matrix elements is not good enough to detect deviations from the leading order intensity relations. Yeah? And for these very good rotors, that has not changed. For these transitional nuclei, things have changed because they are more modern, it seems.
For this 166, it would be interesting to see if the NLO still maintains the line that the data favors.
Absolutely. It would be wonderful to have these error bars significantly reduced.
No, I mean,
I'm sorry.
If you did NLO.
Oh, yeah, but then I have the problem.
You're not allowed to just stop, right? What? You need to go to the next order.
How can I?
What is the next
order? Right, but I cannot fit precise theory to imprecise data.
It's compatible with C2 equal to zero.
Yes, that's right. So here, in this nucleus where the deviations are more pronounced, because the scaling is so the EFT, the separation of scale is small, separation of scale is smaller, the expansion coefficient is larger, and more precise data is available, we could do something.
It's not a next to leading order calculation, you're actually just fitting the next coefficient to the data.
That's right. That's right. In that sense, at least we fit the LECs, for instance, And then, okay, we need two coefficients to fix this line, and then the other points are predictions. Yes?
But why do you say is it not next to leading
order? It is next to leading order. Here it is next to leading order.
It's not a prediction. I guess it went well.
Well,
you're not.
We have more data points than fit parameters.
Yes.
Yes.
Can you give more details? I understand the formula you get at the end, but what exactly is the effective theory and what would the next leading order term be?
Oh, as long as we limit ourselves to just one rotational band, it is just really a power series in I times I plus one.
I guess I'm not understanding. How do you derive that?
This is basically my degree of freedom, the vector that. And I make a velocity out of this. I square the velocity. That's my leading order Lagrangian. I put it to the velocity squared to squared of fourth order, and I get my next to leading order, next to leading order term. This basically, I follow the recipe, write down all allowed terms, but since this is so simple, there's just one, there's just a velocity, you cannot have a potential in the Nambu-Goldstone modes. Sure. Yeah? So it's so embarrassingly simple that that's all what you get is...
Let's get part of the J squared.
Yes, that's right.
One thing is that EFT have normally is that these coefficients are natural in some way. Can you define something, a naturalness? That points to the
C2? Oh, this, I meant to show here that these coefficients here are natural in size. Yes, so that they are natural in size.
How do I see it?
Well, this is, so here what I did is I had the rotational spacing from the lowest line to plus date. And I have
You know, you can get out some scale, and then the coefficient should be order one.
You want to divide one.
I should have divided these numbers by these numbers.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Does the interaction with zero mode doesn't introduce any ambiguity?
Yes, because basically, in that sense, on the sphere you quantize, the only, as I said, the interesting part is only. You can, of course, also now allow here for magnetic monopoles of a certain strength, and thereby, if you couple more degrees of freedoms to it, that actually gives you the normal coupling to extend this to a rotor and vibrations, yeah. Or if you want to have an odd mass nucleus just with a finite ground state spin, but again, because then everything must be nice and quantized, and you have just you get out that you of course have only half or integer spins and so on.
If a monopole, you can get probably half integer, right?
Yes, I could get half integer spins and also maybe the odd mass and odd nuclei.
So, is there any constraint on the sine of C2? Sometimes some of these.
No, it could be both positive and negative. Yeah? And you see here, I'm sorry, no, there's no constraint. And you see here, molecule here has, for instance, a negative while this nucleus is positive.
But the other table, they were all positive, I thought.
No. This here is for the spectrum. Okay, for the spectrum, you can, basically, if you have the naive picture that the nucleus under rotation begins to stretch, then you always get this sign of C2.
Yeah, that's why I was wondering, how did you get a negative C2 for the
other case? No, we don't. This here is the correction to the quadrupole moment. What I've shown here, okay.
So these are all oblate?
What I've shown you here, I'm sorry, what I'm showing you here are quadrupole transition strengths, not how the, so the other things is so, okay, I could also have shown you that, and they would all behave as you physically expect, that the rotating system stretches out, increases its moment of inertia, and thereby flattens the rotational curve.
So what about shape coexistence? How does that work? So you have it simultaneously in two wells.
Right. I do not know how to do this in this framework, because basically then these two frameworks become competing with each other, and or basically in this framework omega becomes of the same order of psi, the vibrational scale comes, or the breakdown scale comes of the same order as the rotational scale, and one would need really a new EFT, or one would, yeah. So maybe so we also wanted to, or had hoped to, maybe that someone remeasures something, yeah? And so there are examples here in erbium-168, very well-studied nucleus, and ytterbium-174. Actually, the measurements have this oscillatory behavior, and that's really impossible to get in EFT, yeah? So of course, we just took here the precision of the, so of course, if this, so it would be interesting for us to see this here, for instance, remeasured, this transition strength, yeah. Likewise, this transition strength or this, yeah. So there are, it would be interesting to see. Not everything is well understood, even for these good rotors. And so, and finally, so basically, I would say now I have shown you only well-known stuff, nothing new. What can the EF2 do that maybe the models have a challenge with? And this is one of these examples. So you have very strong quadrupole transitions in a rotational band, but you have much weaker quadrupole transitions between rotational bands. And also the models give those much weaker than the in-band transitions, but they still overestimate things by factors 2 to 10 or so. Yeah? And here, when you do the effective field theory and put it into an electromagnetic field, you get next to leading order corrections. And unfortunately, you also get new low energy coefficients that the model doesn't have. But if you do this, then now suddenly, here we look here, for instance, these are a table of B2 transitions. Here, this is in the ground state band. So see here, for instance, experimental value, ET business, simple uncertainty estimates, and the Bohr Hamiltonian, and that is all wonderful. But then if you go, for instance, from the so-called gamma band to the ground state band, or from the beta band to the ground state band, you see here quite an over-prediction of the experimental results. Yeah? While the effective field theory, if you drive it to the appropriate order, you will get again. So here the A denotes that we have fixed one low energy coefficient to match this data point. Then this and these are predictions, and now we have a much better agreement with data, and likewise here. Yeah. So in that sense, the weaker interband transitions in the EFT, that's because you systematically build all operators, not only in the Hamiltonian, but also for transition operators, you get actually at the price of no low energy constants, you get the physics right.
But if you take the ratios of these coefficients, you probably get the same number, isn't it?
Say it again.
If you take, for instance, the ratio of the 157 to 110 and the ratio on the empirical side there, would you not get similar numbers?
If you rescale the Bohr Hamiltonian just by the
oh yes, there's an overall. That's right, absolutely. The Bohr Hamiltonian is wrong by an overall factor, but
So that repairs it more or less. I mean, we're taking the ratio. I mean, introducing a new scale.
Yes.
Overall scale.
Yes. Okay, let me just do it in my head that I agree with
but
you.
Not quite,
yes.
But
oh yeah, no, here's 1.5. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I agree with you.
Qualitatively goes in the right direction.
Yeah, I agree with you. So then the last thing, that we can stop any time, is we can also look at vibrational states and the interesting physics there. So I already told you, if you start from quadrupole degrees of freedom, your lowest order Hamiltonian is just the harmonic quadrupole oscillator. It has a 1-phonon state, 3-2-phonon states, 5-3-phonon states, and certain transitions that are well known in this model. Yeah, and the key tension, I would say, that exists is simply we have several nuclei where you look at the spectra and you say, oh, wow, I recognize this. This looks similar. But then if you look really at transition strengths, you would say, oh, that doesn't look so much similar as you would expect it for a quadrupole vibrator. So, and for instance, in 2010, there's a nice review article from Garrett and Wood. They simply ask, where are the quadrupole vibrations in atomic nuclei? Because data not very well matches theory. So we went to revisit this. And basically, as an introduction here, how do we do this? We introduce quadrupole degrees of freedom, couple them to normal scalars as usual. And now here, for instance, in Palladium 106, we have here these dark points are data. And you see, okay, this looks very much like a 1- and 2-phonon state. But then at the 3-phonon level, you see you have already many states. So we basically say, okay, this EFT breaks down at the 3-phonon level. Yeah, that more states than the theory provides you with. So clearly, we have a breakdown scale of something like omega over lambda is 1/3. So it's not a really small parameter, but this is how it is. And empirically, of course, this is not surprisingly, pairing effects are, or breaking of pairs happens at 2 to 3 MeV of excitation. So you reveal the fermionic nature, and a pure bosonic description must, of course, fail. No surprise here. But then to really check whether things work in theory is, of course, you must know your uncertainties. And here we were very much inspired here by Ohio Group's work and applied this to our case. Yeah. So we expanded Hamiltonian observables according to a power counting. We employ, of course, natural assumption as log normal priors here and use Bayes' theorem and follow very much the program laid out here. And then we computed distribution functions and uncertainties and degree of belief intervals. Yeah? To really, and for instance here, already shown here, you have here the uncertainties in pink at leading order and at blue at next to leading order. in this program. And just here, very, very briefly, you have a leading order Hamiltonian. That's just the harmonic. This is a number operator. That's just the harmonic autopole vibrator. And at next to leading order, you have these quartic terms. D is our quartopole phonon operator, and so on. You can work it out. You have an expansion parameter that breaks down at the three phonon state. N is the number of phonons. So and of course, every observable can be expanded now in terms of powers of a leading order term, next to leading order term, and so on. And then we can use the insights from the Ohio groups to define priors of our expectations of how should these coefficients that we fit be distributed. And we make here, for instance, an ensemble of nuclei. And for a Hartzsprung or Gaussian prior, we have something empirical here that we can use. And then we can actually compute. I just scan here the formula. I really don't want to go into details because of time. But one can now use, based on this prejudice or assumption, one can now compute what are expectation values and uncertainties, or for expectation values based on that you have an assumption about that the low energy coefficients of your effective theory are natural in size and distributed, for instance, in natural size here with a log normal prior. So when you do this, for instance, here, we started at leading order, just V2 transitions again. And there's a busy table. There's nothing I want to point out in particular. Only if you really go through this, you have very large uncertainties, about one-third, really. Yeah. And within these uncertainties, these data, this nuclei, so the conditions are well described. Yeah.
Ask this later if you want, but so there's a consistency check then that you do. For example, if you have 68%, then part of them should be outside.
We counted, and that also works. Okay. Yeah. So okay. We have, of course, we have a small number of data points, but yes. Within those assumptions, it does work. We checked that. Yeah. But so that is not exciting here. What is maybe more interesting is that if you go to the leading order quartopole oscillator, there are certain matrix elements that should be, so intrinsic quartopole moments should be zero for many states. Yeah. Yet people have measured them and saw them sizable, almost as large as quartopole transition matrix elements. And that's why the theory was really questioned to apply. But the point is now, if you look at it in an effective theory, you have again an expansion of the quartopole operator. And here now the next to leading order is only 1/3. So it's not much smaller than the leading order transition. You should not have a null expectation, but rather 1/2 smaller than the leading order. And what I show you here is for Palladium 106 and Kutnum 114, basically here static quartopole moment and here higher order transition matrix elements. And again, within our uncertainties, we are not surprised about the size of these matrix elements. And actually, we do a good job even with a simple counting, 1/3 is out. Yeah. So in that sense, we came simply to the conclusion, wow, if you can work and look at these nuclei as quadrupole vibrators, but the breakdown scale is pretty low, it's just 1/3. And then you have, of course, significant deviations from your leading order picture, but data is actually consistent with what you compute. And here I have one more slide to show before my summary. So you can now go on and say, wow, can you describe odd mass nuclei as coupled a fermion to an even nucleus, like a vibrational nucleus? Yeah. So there are many of nuclei here, for instance, that we have. And I have a list of those. Yeah. And actually, we went to the simplest case, of course, low-hanging fruit, simply a spin 1/2 orbital coupled to a vibrating nucleus. And the upshot is actually, yes, this works pretty well. Yeah, you see here, this is the even nucleus. Now you have a spin 0 just gets to a spin 1/2 here. This here basically splits in two orbitals. This stays the same. And then these two again split in two orbitals. And so you get some data. Here we have not shown an experimental result, simply spinners. We have only shown results for definite spin assignments here. There are states, but not definitely known spin assignments. Yeah. And okay, this works pretty well for E2 moments. And one interesting case is here, silver 109. You could think about it as adding a proton to palladium 108, a vibrational nucleus, or of taking a proton out and making a proton hole in cadmium-110, and you see similar quality of description of this nucleus, starting from different EFTs. Okay, so I will not go over this, but you can compute magnetic moments that's interesting in odd mass nuclei. And the upshot is actually that this all works pretty well. Yeah. So let me summarize a lot of things I wanted to cover. So the finite Ostrata basis naturally exhibits UV and infrared cutoffs. And we actually know, I would say, we have a better understanding now how large these are to a good precision, both in a single particle picture or in the no-Korschelle model, and also in many body product spaces that are used in actual calculation. And we know how to extrapolate. We have Lüscher-like formulas for energies, radii, quadrupole moments, transition rates, even radiative capture reactions. Yeah. So we use those insights to construct an EFT directly in the Ostrata basis. It's based on these discrete momentum eigenvalues. Yeah. And it's a DVI momentum space, but we do have to make infrared corrections to some matrix element because there is no zero momentum really in our space. Yeah, so we have to fix that. And then, good, this is work in progress, and I've shown you only a little bit of this. Then I went to EFT for nuclear rotation and vibrations. Good, these are by bosonic degrees of freedom, two different realizations of spherical symmetries, one nonlinear, one linear. And overall, so physics-wise, you get here the correct description of the weak interband transitions with natural size coefficients. That was a, I don't know, small problem in collective models, yeah, because it's such, these coefficients are so much more fainter than the strong leading order in-band transitions. And for vibrations, actually, you do consistent. You can say that certain nuclei are really just anharmonic, exhibit anharmonic vibrations, and data both on even nuclei and certain odd nuclei. This is very consistent with this picture within the still sizable uncertainties that we have here. Thank you.
So I have one comment on Lüscher's formula. Lüscher's formula is not extrapolation formula. It's liaison between finite energy and scattering fields, not extrapolation. It's exact liaison. Only extrapolation in the bound state energy.
When I use the, I hope that this is only semantics. When I use the word extrapolation formulas, I basically, what we of course want to do is we want to relate the finite basis result to the infinite result, and so we use it in practice to extrapolate results.
So it's Lüscher for paper number one, not number two.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. One is on scattering, one is on bound states. That's right.
Bound state is indeed expressed.
Yes. Yes. So yes. So we have of course so far here only bound states in mind.
Even for scattering states, you have to have large enough lattices, right?
Yeah, but
because for small lattices, you see a next lattice, and then you get these.
No. It doesn't matter.
The small.
Interaction length is small.
Yeah, but when you have the exponential corrections, not the power law corrections.
So it's exponential correction. It's supposed to be small.
So the lattice has to be big enough that you get rid of these.
It's exponential. Yeah. But issue is the finite wave effect of the brain wave.
Okay, well timed.